One quick addition from last night at the conclusion. Remember the rather amusing comment that Brother Ray made about me taking my glasses off a half a dozen times, Ray, I think you said, at least. A brother who will remain unnamed came up to me afterwards and he said, "You know, Bill, that's not a nervous habit." I said, "No, I know it's not." He said, "As a matter of fact, when a speaking brother does remove his glasses and looks the audience in the eyes, that he in fact is getting closer to them. It's a signal of warmth." Well, I really never thought of it that way, but he's absolutely correct. I have to use, because of my age, I have to use glasses if I'm reading from the scriptures or notes. We all have that. I'm sure a lot of us have that malady, if we can use it. However, there are some of us who possess the kind of vision I have. I can see 4 feet out without any difficulty. And I do prefer, and that's why I have the half glasses, I do prefer to remove those glasses quite often when I am impromptu addressing something. And that's what this brother was saying. So that tends to bring a warmth in the communication process. Now, that's something you don't do on a planned basis. But it's an observation I think that was rather valid. Another one, when Brother Zim said, "What do you do to stop a sneeze when you push, you know, touch your nose? What do you sneeze or you touch your nose?" What we were referring to, brethren, was nervous habits, repetitive habits. Those who, you know, constantly stroke their chin or constantly rub their nose or constantly the back of their neck in an unconscious way. Obviously, if you're going to sneeze or cough, that's the exception, acceptable, and your audience knows it. The difference is very, very real between something that your audience can appreciate and understand and accept as opposed to something that will become an irritant to them. You understand the difference? And this is what we were trying to bring out. Well, with that, we'll get back to the area that we were addressing. This business of helpful points in terms of retaining this keen sense of communication. Not only do we, to the maximum extent possible, look the audience right in the eye, and that varies anywhere from a minimum maybe of 20 to 25% to a maximum, as I suggested last night, of 90%, and there are ways to do it, and we will address some of them. But there are other little techniques, very legitimate, valid techniques that can be used to ensure the retention of the audience attention to what you're trying to say. Now, obviously, when you're dealing with a public lecture, this is very important. But I would suggest, with all humbleness, that it's no less important in terms of our exhortation with our brothers and sisters, whom we know very well. We don't want to bore them. We want to lift them up, exhort. So the use of these techniques, quite legitimate. Nothing wrong with it at all. For example, always be very conscious of appropriately using what we call direct address style. Personal pronouns. You. We, us, our. Those give the listeners a sense of being one group. Now, obviously, we don't have to overemphasize that when we're dealing with an exhortive posture in our ecclesia, but it's extremely important in a public lecture setting. The last thing you want a visiting friend or stranger to feel is separation from your group. In other words, us's and them's. Don't want to do that. You want to do everything possible to minimize that, to make them feel comfortable. And when you begin to use those personal collective pronouns, either in your extemporaneous notes or in your written manuscript, think about it. Small, but very, very important. Another technique that has to be carefully used, but it's a very, very good technique, is the process of recognizing individuals by name. That can even be done in a public lecture situation, if in fact you happen to have a neighbor or a friend in. And you can sort of roll into that situation very appropriately. Tell you what it does. It makes that person, whether it's a brother or sister or a visitor, feel that you are personally involved in giving a communication to them and taking one from them. There's nothing more emphatic than doing that. I'll be talking, for example, and this is an example, in terms of the dedication to the truth. That which requires our priority application of time and money. For example, Brother Tom drives 135 miles to meeting. Well, that makes Brother Tom feel that he's part of this exchange, but it also has a spillover in terms of those who can empathize with Brother Tom. It begins to solidify the sense of communication. Got to be used very carefully, but it can. Another thing, it can be used very carefully. This is the thing that I threatened Brother Ray with. Now, there I did. I just simply alluded to a name. But it's what I threatened Brother Ray with last night when he suggested that he might fall asleep in a rather amusing way. I said, no, you won't either. Believe it or not, brethren, again carefully used, the technique of raising collective or individual questions during the course of your exhortation or lecture is very, very valid. It enhances, it elevates the sense of communication between the speaker and the audience. We are in a materialistic society. We're part and parcel of a society that's going down the road to destruction by their own devices faster than anything could be imagined 50 years ago. I just bought a new automobile. I paid a horrendous figure for freight. Brother Ray, you didn't have to pay that, did you, when you bought a new car? Point. I know he's from Detroit. You see the point? Now, all that did was to sharpen a point, sometimes very subtly, but if appropriately used, quite effective. And you'd be surprised how it can be used in terms of dealing with the truth. Remember the axiom we tried to lay out first night. There is absolutely nothing to the myth that capable, competent use of public speaking principles shouldn't be used in terms of enhancing our exhortive and public lecture efforts. And the more you can get a communication between you as the speaker, whether you're a neophyte or an experienced speaker, and your audience, the better off you are. The better off you are. I have no apologies for belaboring that point. It's a very valid point, brethren. And I would suggest that you try never to forget it. Now, I suggested last night that we would address some psychological aspects of a teacher's task. There are a number, and I don't want to belabor the point beyond a point of boredom. But I want you to understand this. Almost all human activity is prompted by stimuli. I think all of us know what the word stimuli means. I was giving this series of classes to some young brethren a few years ago, and one brother put up his hand and says, what stimuli? I said, you are. He says, oh, I'm going to explain this. All human activity is influenced by stimuli, negative and positive. And speech is certainly a human activity, whether it's a conversation one-on-one or whether it's a structured, systematic proposition such as an exhortation or a lecture. When a person is listening to a speech, exhortation, lecture, class, when a person is listening to a speech, he is being or she is being subjected to a variety of stimuli. A variety of stimuli. Now a speaker, and remember this is what we're dealing with, the fundamentals of public speaking. A speaker must be aware of all forms of influences. That's what stimuli is, influence. A speaker must be aware of these forms if he wishes to command the situation. And which one among us doesn't wish to command the situation when we're trying to put over an exhortive idea or to teach the basic truth in a lecture? That's our whole reason for doing what we're doing, isn't it? We wish to command the situation. Therefore, a speaker must be aware of the variety of stimuli. There are things he must learn to do to control or minimize stimuli. Well, what am I talking about? Just as an example, there obviously is visual stimuli for the audience. Now remember this. We're talking about those to whom you are addressing your remarks. There's visual stimuli for the audience. Put yourself in the speaker's position now, which some of you obviously are in, or very soon will be, and think this way. You have got to think that the people in your audience, whether it's 10 people, 100 people, or 1,000 people, may have to concern themselves with what's going on outside the window. The crying baby you asked me about, Harry. More about that in a moment. But the visual stimuli is what they can see out the window, the decorations in the room, the lady's hat sitting in front of them. Think about it a minute. They're there. They're there. And you'd better be aware that they're there and try to minimize the impact that they may have to distract your hearer from what you are saying. Doesn't mean you can go out and take that hat off, although I did that once in a lecture, believe it or not, in Panama. I thought the woman was going to throw something at me until she realized that I was taking the hat pin out to use it to illustrate the pricking at Pentecost. And then she was delighted that I took her hat off. But it was a double-edged sword. I wanted the pin, but her hat was blocking the vision of three people that were trying to see around it. I knew that. I was aware of it. And I took rather drastic action to do something about it. You'd be careful in an American ecclesia doing that, but in Panama you could do it. There's audible stimuli that you've got to be aware of. Agitation, disturbances of various kinds, noises in the place of assembly, or from the outside. Creaking floors. If you happen to have an old building the way we have, we've got a door. Haven't we, Brother Tom? A door in the back of the meeting hall. It's a lovely old meeting hall. We're delighted with it. But when that door is opened a certain way, it goes, kick, and everybody in the meeting, 50 or 60 people, hear that. If that speaker lets it bother him, he's in trouble, you see. Just a little thing, but a creaking floor, a noisy door, coughing, shuffling of feet, various vehicles, loud motorcycles without mufflers, barking dogs, and hairy crying babies. What do you do about a crying baby? That's a rhetorical question. I'm going to give you an answer. The point is that the speaking brother, in whatever context he finds himself, must never, ever let that upset him. There are several ways it can be handled. Most ecclesias have rather loose rules as to what happens when a child is disturbing the meeting. As Brother Harry and I exchanged, there was one English brother at least who, when that happens, will stop. He'll say nothing more until that child is quieted or removed from the room. doesn't lose his patience, doesn't lose his cool, doesn't get mad, just does that. Years ago, when my eldest, who's now 37, was a little boy sitting with his mother up front who was playing the organ, she was having trouble with him that day. It didn't usually happen. He was usually very good. And I was speaking, and it was bugging me, I'll tell you frankly. It was my son. And I knew he was troubling the whole meeting, and he was troubling Dad. And what I was trying to say was being interrupted. So finally I stepped aside, and I looked right at my wife, and I said, "Sister Butts, you may take that child out right now." There was a collective sigh of relief in the entire meeting, because the meeting was concerned that I was worried, you see? They knew that that was my son, and they knew it was bugging me. Now, that's an extreme way of handling something like that, but the point I'm trying to make by the use of that illustration is that the speaking brother, the presiding brother, has it within his power to release the tension that is disturbing the carrying out of the message. Another example that I happened to be involved in many years ago, extreme, but it proves the point. Be right with you, Bob, if you'll hold it. I was giving an afternoon address in a little country church building down in Bethany, Virginia. This was back in the early 50s. Summertime, no screens, hot, windows wide open, and there was a horrendous thunderstorm came up. Metal roof. All right? I was right in the middle of really pumping things out. Do you think anybody was listening to me? See what you do when... Do you think anybody was listening to me? They were worried about all the open windows in their automobiles. You see? They were wondering, what's happening? What's getting wet? Well, if I could have kept droning on, but it wouldn't have done a thing. Everything I would have said would have gone right through the ears. So I stopped. And I said, "Please, everybody, quick, let's take a 5-minute break. Go out and close your windows." And they all scooted out, came back, and were relaxed, and I carried on. Well, that was almost by intuitive reflexing, because that was a number of years ago. Point being, though, that the speaking brother must respond to what's going on, that stimuli, whatever form it takes, whether it's visual stimuli or audible stimuli. You've got to be aware of it. And you can be very much more effective when you are. Yes, Bob, you had a question. Yes. I was speaking. It was right in the middle of an exhortation. Right in the middle of an exhortation. Now, I wouldn't recommend that. I'm simply saying that was a drastic action that I had to take to retain the sense of comfort. Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, it did. It did. Bob is remembering a point where this child of the speaking brother at the time broke away from the mother in the audience and tip, 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 right up on the platform, sat right down in the presiding chair. Well, you know what happened to the people in the audience. They weren't listening to that brother. They were watching that child. If I remember correctly, Bob, and correct me if I'm wrong, that speaking brother just casually went over and picked up the child and handed it either back to its mother or you or somebody. I don't recall how but he didn't get ruffled. But by taking action, he retained the attention on the proper sense and not everybody laughing at what the child was doing. That brings me to a presiding point, and I might make that right now. A presider, and I mean this in all seriousness, has the most important job, if I can use the word job, in a meeting, the most important task. Because that presider is forced by circumstances to deal in an impromptu structure. It is he who must always read what's going on in the meeting and take certain actions. Somebody who walks into the hall late, not recognized. somebody gets sick. I mean, he's up there, he can see what's going on. He's the one that has to react to the exhortation, set the tone of the meeting. He's the one that runs the meeting. For that reason, brethren, and I'm not dogmatic on this, but for that reason, the brethren in Washington for many, many years in bringing along young brethren have always required a young brother to have a year and a half to 2 years of platform experience in speaking before he's ever considered as a presider. Subtle difference. The reason being that a presider has got to be comfortable on the platform. He's the one who's going to have to react if certain things call for his reaction. I remember a young brother not too long ago who, in presiding, knocked over the wine at the table. Knocked over the wine. A whole cup hit the white linen, and you know what happened. All the sisters gasped. But I'll tell you something. That young brother didn't drop a note. He would have had he not already had presence of platform. But that young brother didn't drop a note. He paused maybe 3 seconds and acknowledged by his eyes that that had happened. But he didn't lose his train of thought. He didn't change the inflection in his voice. He knew that the doorkeeper was watching that. And that doorkeeper, in a matter of a minute and a half, had a replacement cup with wine in it. It was a beautiful expression of keeping one's cool. Now, that young brother probably wouldn't have succeeded in doing that. And I believe a couple people in this audience were there when that happened. I see a smile back there. I think at least one was. That's what I mean about platform presence. Now, let's get back to the stimuli bit. The stimuli, which must dominate all other, whether it's visual or audible, is obviously the speaker himself, if he's to be successful in getting over his exhortive points or his public lecture points. Visually, the stimuli will come from his appearance and his dress and from his bodily activity. From his appearance, his dress, and his bodily activity. If a speaker is shabbily dressed, has long, scraggly hair, is unkempt in the way he approaches things, believe me, whoever the audience is going to notice it. Now, that don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting that a speaker has to wear a tuxedo and have a hair trim 24 hours before he gets on the platform. I don't mean that. I am simply saying that a speaker must be aware of the fact that the way he is dressed, the way he looks, I'm not talking beauty versus non-beauty. I'm not meaning that. The way he's dressed, the way he looks, and the way he comports himself bodily is a visual stimuli that's going to make or break, in some instances, what goes on. Audibly, they will consist of nonverbal stimuli as the inflection, now watch this, as the inflection, the loudness of voice, the pitch quality, and the rate of utterance. And the speaker's words, on the other hand, are obviously the verbal stimuli. And did you get that subtle difference? What is said, the words themselves, are the verbal stimuli. The non-verbal stimuli is the inflection, the loudness, and the rate of utterance. We had a young brother in Washington not long ago who gave his maiden exhortation in another meeting. And he called me up the night before he left, and he said, "Brother Bill, what last-minute instructions can you give me?" I said, "It's too late to teach you anything more. All I can tell you is take your time. Take your time. Take your time." He came back 2 days later, and he says, "That's all I could think about while I was exhorting. Take my time. Take my time." I said, "Did you take your time?" He says, "I think so." The point is, he remembered that very cardinal rule. One of the finest, most intelligent, competent, productive brethren the Christadelphian community has talks too fast. And I think all of you know who I'm referring to. And that brother himself knows it, particularly for North American audiences. He talks like a machine gun. And it is a very, very difficult thing to overcome in terms of his hearers. Many of his hearers, those who know him well, have reacted to this and have said so. And he takes it in a very constructive criticism way. Point for even mentioning this is that the rate of utterance, brethren, is very important. We will get to enunciation and articulation and pronunciation probably tomorrow night, if not tonight. But the rate of utterance is very, very important. You want your hearers to hear you. You want them to understand what you're saying. And if you talk so fast that they can't keep up, you've lost the battle. Or if you drop off at the end of a sentence, which a lot of speakers do, they'll articulate a sentence beautifully, a phrase, a paragraph even, and then they'll swallow the last word or last two phrases. And you'll almost see people, what did he say? What did he do that for? Now, that's not something that you're consciously doing, either on the receiving or the giving end. It's simply one of those little elements that a speaker must work on, must be aware of. More about that a bit later. You see, we must be aware of these things which impinge upon a hearer. A speaker must be aware of these things which impinge upon a hearer. And such are the kinds of stimuli that a speaker must learn to control or at least minimize. He must not let them control him or his audience. In other words, his stimuli, his inflection, his rate, his loudness, what he says, his voice quality, that's his stimuli. His stimuli, that emanating from him, especially the spoken language and all of its ups and downs, is his task to make himself an effective exhorter or lecturer. Now, there are a couple of observations I'd like to make at this stage of the game that may be a bit redundant in terms of something I've already said, but if that's the case, so be it. A speaker's special function in the making of ideas and information understandable to other people is just that. That's what a speaker is all about, to make ideas and information understandable to other people. He's not talking to himself. A most valuable asset to enhance or to ensure this is therefore a ready, large, comprehensive store of ideas, information, and other supporting material for his explanation and or his arguments. Now, obviously, we have a storehouse right here in terms of what we're concerned with. And I'm not suggesting for a moment that a speaker cannot limit himself strictly to this. He can. He can. But when you begin to concern yourself with trying to preach the gospel to the interested, cynical, or skeptical, and there are three different classifications there, interested, cynical, or skeptical person, you'd better have a database of supportable material rather than just declarations or assertions on your part. When you talk about the authority of the Bible, for example, obviously the Bible attests to its own authority. Certainly it does. But suppose you have somebody in the audience who says, well, I don't accept that. Do you have any other material that would convince me that this is an authoritative document? Where do you find that, brethren and sisters? Where do you find that kind of information? This is just one illustration I'm putting out to you. You have to dig to create that database that I've alluded to several times of information of authoritative nature that the skeptic or the cynic or the interested party might take as initial authority as opposed to what you actually quote from the book itself. I'm not suggesting you don't quote from the book. I'm suggesting that you use every weapon at your disposal. And that weapon is not at your disposal if you don't get it and put it in your database. Now, again, this gets into the area of general preparation for an exhortation or a lecture. Observing, thinking, investigating, conversing, and even writing, which a speaker can do. And I can assure you, brethren and sisters, that a brother can never do too much of it. I will admit quite honestly that all of us, in various degrees, fall far short of doing as much as we should. No question about it. But I want you to understand the axiom. You can never do too much of it. Remember that calf path illusion I made, the first night? I just happened to pick that up under the glass of a colleague's desk back in 1950. It impressed me, but what I did was to drop it into a file. And it's become a tremendous use to me on a number of occasions as I've gone through my life to accumulate, observe, read, and think. On the one hand, with a specific objective in mind, if you know what you're going to talk about. On the other hand, a general collection of information that might someday, at some time, become very valuable to you in terms of developing the carrying out of your responsibilities. If you do that on an orderly basis, make it your point to do it. If you haven't done it yet, start doing it. Your files may bulge. You may never use everything. But believe me, the existence of it will become an invaluable asset to you. Young brethren particularly, and us old war horses too for that matter, if we have to recultivate, we will. But if you're young and starting out, please cultivate the habit of remembering incidents, stories, examples, illustrations, information of any kind which you may encounter. Wherever you encounter it, cultivate the habit of doing it. Every one of us observe things for 12 to 18 hours a day. Now we've got two options at least. We can have the option of saying, well, yeah, that's going on, and then promptly forget it. Or, with the mind, having our responsibility, knowing what we're going to have to do on a regular basis, catalog those things. Think about them. I carry a little notebook with me all the time. I don't use it as often as I should, but I do use it. And if I see something, because I'm getting a little, a little more difficult to remember now than I used to, I'll jot it down. I will tear little things out of the paper or out of the magazine. I'm sure all of you do this more or less. The point I'm trying to make, and I don't want to belabor it anymore, is to make it a habit. Cultivate that habit. You'd be surprised how valuable it becomes in conjunction with, of course, the greatest source of our information going. You see, when you do this, you can develop the ability in your presentation or writing the process of illustrating and amplifying your ideas rather than just being content with a bald assertion unsupported. The technique that's applicable to the truth, brothers and sisters. We can baldly assert that we do not believe in the Trinity and the Bible does not teach it. Now, we all know that that's a true statement. The best way to amplify that is to take 3 or 4 minutes and give the pedigree as to how the doctrine of the Trinity came into being. Where do you find that pedigree? I can tell you if you want to know. I have it tucked into my file, and I can pull it out anytime I want to. location and date as to how it came into being. And I use that only when it's necessary, but you see, that's the type of thing that I'm talking about. There are five general steps in the preparation of an exhortation or lecture. Five general steps. Now, you can modify these in terms of your own habits to the extent you want to. But let's think of them chronologically. The first one is almost obvious, is to select a subject or have it selected for you. The second one is finding and collecting the material, the kinds of things that I've been talking about, whether it's biblical sources or elsewhere. Brother Harry Tennant happens to be one of our teachers here at Bible School. I remember the first visit he made to Washington in 1958, when I was somewhat younger than I am now. And Brother Harry was giving a Bible class in our home, and he sat in the middle of our living room, and we had about 40 people jammed into the living room and the dining area, listening to this Bible class by this very well-known British brother. 1958 was the date. And after he was through, I mean, he just awed us by his presentation that night. Just great. One of our younger brethren at the time asked him, he said, "Brother Tennant, how in the world did you come up with so much correlated information on the subject matter you used tonight?" Brother Harry didn't talk about an encyclopedia at the time. He didn't talk about a Bible dictionary. He didn't talk about any of the extraneous points, but he did talk about a concordance. He's alluded to concordance several times already this week. He said, "The first thing I do when I hit a phrase or word that I'm going to develop," and the glory the other night was a good example, he says, "I look up every reference in the Bible involving that phrase or term." He said, with respect to tonight, I've never forgotten this, he said, "The half a dozen or so scriptures I use tonight are six of 130 that I looked at before I developed this class." Now, I'm not saying that I can do that or that I would expect you to do it. All I'm saying is the principle is solid. I do, generally speaking personally, I do generally look at about three, four, or five times as many references as I end up using in an exhortation or a lecture. But not 130 versus six, which happened to be the example he gave that particular night. But the principle is solid. The principle is solid. In other words, you select that subject, then you find and collect the materials, and then out of that database, you do the selecting of what is applicable to the time frame and the thrust that you want to make. And that varies, brethren. That varies. I'm already working on, I've been asked to teach at a Bible school next year. I'm already working on three subjects. Just initially starting, but I'm already beginning to collect that data. I'm getting older and I procrastinate more. I probably wait until I get too close to it and then, begin to spin your wheels. But I've already started. I know that it's a thing to do. That's what I'm trying to say to you. And if I stick by the rules that I'm trying to suggest to you, I will continue it apace. I will continue it apace to create that body of material from which the selection comes. And you'd be surprised how effective that becomes. And all of a sudden, it dawns on you, why didn't I do this before? If you've never done it, why didn't I do this before? Consciously develop the database, and I use that term in a generic sense, everything. And then you begin to pull from that everything in terms of that which is appropriate to what you're going to do. And then, and not until then, do you write your exhortation or lecture or prepare your outline. And then what's the fifth step? We already mentioned it last night. You rehearse aloud. That's right. Practice, practice, practice. The three cardinal rules of public speaking. Get to that. I will do. Don't know that I might be able to touch on it tonight here, but you're right. We'll get to that in terms of how you handle that manuscript. Now, the importance of selecting a good subject. That's the first step. Remember the five general steps. Selecting the subject, finding and collecting the material, selecting the ideas and supporting material that will support what you're going to say and do, preparing the outline, and then rehearsing. Those are the five steps in chronological order. Now, the importance of selecting a good subject. This is something I believe that we probably, as a community, tend to fall down on. That doesn't mean that individual brethren don't do it very well. They do. But as a community, we tend to sometimes give this short shrift. I think that's the term that's used in the common vernacular today. What am I talking about? When we select a subject, it must be appropriate to the audience, to the occasion, and to the time frame. Now, let me repeat those because they're applicable in terms of an exhortation just as much as they are to a general speech. They must be appropriate to the audience. That's easy enough for us by and large, except our age situation. Must be appropriate to the audience, to the occasion, and to the time frame. When you take those three elements, it does one of two things. In fact, it may do both of them. It may make your job easier in terms of selecting a subject because it gets all the niff-naw out of the way. Or it may dictate for you what the subject's going to be. The theme of this Bible school, we all know it from the gold letters on the blue velvet, about the feet of those who proclaim the gospel. That's the theme of preaching, the ask, advancement of scriptural knowledge. That's the theme. I don't know whether you've noticed it or not, but at least a half a dozen of the addresses we've heard have been appropriate to that theme. Did you notice that? Now that means that the brother has thought about that. He knew what that theme was, and his selection of subject matter was designed to be appropriate to that occasion. To the audience, when you're in a Bible school, your addresses are going to have to be expanded to a wider spectrum than the narrow structure of your own ecclesia. And a competent brother will bring that in consideration. He'll bring it to bear when he thinks about how he's going to go about the task. The time frame, already at least two allusions have been made to the time frame this week. We may hear more before we're through. Now that time frame, brothers and sisters, can be a time frame within a seasonal concept, a historic concept, or an age concept. And it's worth thinking about. It's worth thinking about when you are selecting a subject. You don't just willy-nilly yank it off the wall. Oh, we're tempted to do that sometimes, to grab a subject and say, now what can I say about it? And you go about collecting it, but it may be totally inappropriate to the occasion that you're going to speak, or where you're going to speak, or who you're going to speak to. And that's true, brethren, even in the Christadelphian community. Please remember that. You see, what this does, when you select a good subject on your own, it gives you a leg up psychologically. If you're convinced that your selection does this, you believe either that you know more about it than your audience, and that may not necessarily be the case in a Christadelphian ecclesia, we know that, or, and this is something the brethren ought to think about, or you have a new slant on it, and therefore you will want to address others and be stimulated to prepare more thoroughly than if we go into a last-ditch proposition. Gee, I exhort tomorrow. I better get to work on it. Now, obviously, In a Christadelphian setting, we've got the situation particularly for young brethren. They know that they're faced with an audience out there who probably knows as much or more about the subject matter than they do. And that can be an intimidating thing, you see. But that's why the or is in this element I just gave you. You may very well have a new slant on something. But always remember that what you're going to say after you have been stimulated to prepare that talk on something that you said, gee, I want to give them this idea or this slant or this impression. Remember, you know what you're going to say and they don't. You know and they don't. And as a result, there's no reason in the world why you can't be properly and legitimately not aggressive, no, but properly assertive in terms of putting forth what you want to get over. Now, an important point. If you believe you have an interesting subject, remember that's important. If you believe it, you're selecting it and you believe it, if you believe you have an interesting subject, you will invariably put the stamp of your own personality on that talk. Now, that's true, brethren, in the truth. You may be talking about something that everybody in the audience knows as much about as you do. But if you've got an interesting subject and you're convinced of it, you're going to put your own personality stamp on that talk. You may have picked up ideas from a number of sources. Same scriptures that this brother looks at daily, I look at. And we pick up from the same source. No question about that. No question about it. From a number of different sources. But you, as the speaker, have to, first of all, react in your own way to that source material. And secondly, you'll then turn this to your use and purpose. In other words, the idea that you want to get over. And you'll give it the emphasis of your own coloring. Let me try to illustrate what I'm talking about. There's nobody in this room who is not aware of the scriptural citation in Ecclesiastes talking about the dead lion, the dog and the lion situation. I'm getting a little tired. I can't quote it. It's better than a dead lion or something of that nature. And then it talks about later on in the Ecclesiastes proposition about all our love and our memory and what have you gone, there is no memory in the grave whether thou goest and what have you. You know that that is one of our classic references to disprove the immortality of the soul. Every one of us can turn those to us, Ecclesiastes 5 and Ecclesiastes 9. Those are the two prime chapters there. We can all turn them up. We've heard them for decades, in some cases just years. But how would one put a slant on that if I was interested in involving that particular scripture in a lecture? Maybe what I'm going to say now is absolutely what you think about. But I like to use the double negative. Ladies and gentlemen, and I read these quotations, I believe, and the Christadelphians respectfully suggest to you, that this supports the idea that there is no such thing as an immortality of the soul. It is so plain that it's difficult for a rational person to combat that. But let me suggest to you how one rational person tries to combat it. And then I would turn to a note from Schofield or from Harper, who tries to explain away those scriptures. And by reading, by merely, brothers and sisters now, I just gave you an example for the ladies and gentlemen, by merely reading the attempt to explain away those scriptures from these highly respected commentators, which is so weak and so shallow and so self-defeating that I've made my point. Now that's the way I might do something on something that we are all very, very familiar with. But I like to use the double negative. And when I can find something like that, I will do it. So, regardless of the old material, And this is the case with you young brethren. You're going to deal with something that brethren have dealt with for 130 years. You're always going to put your own stamp on it if it's something that's interesting. Because the talk you're coming up with is something that only you can produce. It's your product. Unless you're a total plagiarist and pick up something that Brother Roberts wrote and read it word for word, which of course is not what you want to do. But it's your product. It may be full of old notions and what have you, but by your treatment, it becomes your product. Now, a word of warning about selecting a subject. This is particularly true for the younger brethren. Don't ever tackle a subject that you cannot cover in the allotted time. A terrible failing on the part of most of us. We get carried away in our enthusiasm for a subject. And if we are limited to a 25 or 30 or 35 minute exhortation time frame, which I think most ecclesias have, we make a terrible mistake, not only for our hearers, but for ourselves, if we try to select a subject that we cannot adequately cover in that time frame. This obviously is true in a lecture. Anytime you're giving a public lecture and you have visitors present, and you leave them hanging out there because you've tried to cover more material than the time frame comfortably permitted, you've done a disservice to the truth, not a service. You've left them confused. Never try to cover more than the time frame will allot you to do, which then forces you into the subject matter. Brethren, what it does is not necessarily say you cannot treat of a subject, but what it does is limit the number of citations that you will use to support it. And that is appropriate to the tenor of an individual. I have learned through years of experience that with respect to me, talking about myself, in an exhortation, I will never have more than 5 or 6 citations. That's the maximum number of citations that I can comfortably use in the time frame of the way I will develop an exhortation. A public lecture never exceeds 9 or 10 maximum, although I may have 50 that I could use. You see, it's that database proposition again. So that's a very serious warning. Never tackle a subject or the structure for that subject greater than the time frame permits. Yes, Brother Reuben. I'm going to give you an opinion, Reuben, and that's really all it is. I think an appropriate exhortation involving the hymns, the prayers, the table, presiding brother at the table, an exhortation should never exceed 35 minutes. It's more comfortably in the 25 to 30 minute range. Two reasons for that. Not only are there other things that have to be appropriately done in our memorial service, but the minute you get to the point where you are going to lose some of your audience, your whole purpose is shot. Your whole purpose is shot. And the best way to preclude that, again, in my experience, and this is simply an opinion, is to make sure that what you say, and you do it very effectively. And you can do that in 25 to 30 with a maximum of 35 minutes. Oh, there are rare exceptions to that. I admit that. But a brother who deals with a subject matter, particularly on the exhortive basis, in an orderly, systemic way, in the half hour, give or take a few minutes time frame, he's going to hold that audience every minute of the way, and he's going to make his point and sit down. And we'll have something to say about that tomorrow night in terms of how you develop a talk. Now, there are some essential steps, and we're about through for this evening, but there are several essential steps in finding material. In finding material, it's funny for me to say this, but I will. First of all, A brother ought to sit down and think about what he already knows. Think about what you already know. You may surprise yourself. You may know a lot more than you thought you did about the subject you've either selected or has been given to you to develop. So that's the first thing you want to do. Take stock of what you already know, what you already think, what you already believe. Now you can do that by jotting that down. Frankly, I'll tell you, that's exactly the way I start to develop a subject matter myself. Before I turn a page, I sit down and jot down what I already think or believe or factually know about a given subject. You'd be surprised what a litany of information you can come up with. Every one of you sitting in this room, young or old, can do that. To give yourself a half hour, 45 minutes to do it, you can do it. In fact, if I was going to have a full 6-day session here, I would give you an assignment. I'd give you a subject and say, write down what you know about that without turning up a page. You'd be surprised what you'd come up with. A second source in terms of finding material. Put your antenna up. Listen. Converse with your family, with your brothers and sisters, with your colleagues. I've had more than one great idea develop by listening and conversing with the employees that work for me. Because I was conscious of it, and I did it, and I jot that down. Amazed how often that was you. I know that Brother Zim has done that too. Observe. Observe. Use your eyes and your mental eyes. Observe what goes on around you. And investigate. How many of you were at the Moorestown Mid-Atlantic gathering? A couple of you did. You remember the allusion that was made about the conductor on the train? That's a typical example of what I'm talking about, observing and investigating. That was a fantastic thing, and it became a good seedbed for some observation. The rest of you don't know what we're talking about, and I apologize to you, but the point is that came from this point I'm trying to make, to observe. Keep your eyes open, your antenna up, and investigate something when you see it aborning. Scriptural subjects are susceptible to this. You don't push this business aside simply because it's a scriptural subject. Read. Read more than one source. Read to learn and understand. Read carefully. Read carefully. Always comprehend the context of what you are reading. If you do these, if you follow that kind of strong suggestion, the database that you create, however much a neophyte you consider yourself to be, will astound you. And you'll say, why didn't I do this before? You'll come up with a sheaf from which you can begin to select. I don't care what the subject matter is. Note-taking should always accompany your reading, your observation, and your thinking. All stages of your gathering of material. Now let's get practical for the last moment tonight, and I will be very practical tomorrow night in the time frame we have. But with respect to note-taking, brethren, do it on a uniform surface. I don't care what that surface is, but do it on a uniform surface. Obviously, a 3x5 card is perfect. They tuck into this pocket up here. They tuck into your pants pocket. You can tuck them anywhere. And if you carry, you know, you can buy them at any drugstore. If you carry just 3 or 4 of them around with you, they don't bulge your pocket. They don't get in the way. But if you have a uniform source, you can take it on in a notebook. A lot of brethren carry notebooks around. That's fine. Nothing wrong with that. But make it uniform, because the minute you get out of the uniform structure, you're going to find yourself losing the material. You'll have no way to catalog it if, in fact, you're inclined to catalog it. It's always wise, particularly on material outside of the scriptures, but I'm going to have a quick comment to make about them too, to date when you saw something and when you took the note. To date it. And talking about dates and the context of when you use the scriptures, one of the finest methods of getting your audience to understand is to let them know when something was written in the scriptures. Not only who's doing the talking, but who they are talking to, or to whom they are talking. Very important. And it's amazing how it enlightens people. I was debating John chapter 12, verse 48 with a brother not too long ago. And I asked him, I said, young fellow, when do you think that was written? Well, I'm not sure. I said, well, the scholars seem to think that the Gospel of John was written after John wrote the three epistles, 1, 2, and 3. The burden of scholarly intent is that the Gospel was written after. Probably sometime around the decade of 70 to 80 A.D. Can't pin it down accurately, but that's the circa, you see. Now, what's the point of this? When you were talking about John 12, 48, you were talking about Jesus referring to people to whom he had spoken, who would be judged by his word. And when did the destruction of Jerusalem take place? Well, 70 A.D. Oh, that's another date you can put up there. Now, John knew that that had taken place. The fact of the matter is he was about to be incarcerated on the Isle of Patmos. But he also made it clear that Christ, when he said that, how old was Jesus Christ when he was crucified? You see what I'm driving at? I'm not going to go through the whole argument. But I use the date